Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Coming up this program, I have that long-promised vaccine discussion. We're going to delve into vaccines, how they're made, what the normal timeline is, and how COVID-19 has been a major game changer in so many ways. But, you know, technology was also really pre-adapted to being able to deal with this. And we'll talk more about that. But before we go any further, I wanted to just discuss what I saw last evening. I took a long walk along West Cliff, and there was a real confusion. People are striding down the path, and some were masked, some weren't masked. I have it from the mouth of the Santa Cruz County Public Health Officer, Dr. Gail Newell. If you are exercising, riding your bicycle, running, or even walking quickly, you do not need to be wearing a mask. We have lots of data that are telling us that you're much safer outside. We have data saying that maybe 15 minutes of contact in a closed space is enough to spread the disease. But outside of that situation, passing by someone on the path, we can drop our paranoia. And boy, am I glad to hear that. So let me just emphasize, if you are sitting somewhere and you do not have a mask on, you need to be 6 feet away. If you are wearing a mask, you can probably get a little bit closer, but don't eat anything. But if you're exercising or you're moving through space, you have a extremely low probability of contracting anything from the air. And of course, wash your hands before you put anything in your mouth, and you'll probably be fine. If it's allergy season, which it has been for me for the last month, I've been wearing a mask just to keep my hands off of my nose. But that, which is good because you can only wash your hands or hand sanitize so many times in 5 minutes. A couple of, almost a month ago now, it's doing its usual strange thing for me as well as everybody else. We had an interview on the program. This aired on the 6th of May, and it was published on the website AskDrDawn.com on the 8th. And this was an hour-long interview with Dr. Howard Kornfield, who is part of a COVID-19 task force, who were promoting something called the MATH Plus Protocol. And that stood for methylprednisolone, ascorbic acid, thiamine, and heparin. And they were promoting beginning all of these agents early and basing this on data and published papers for SARS. Well, subsequent to that, I attended also last night while walking on the cliffs, I attended a Zoom meeting. I do love the new technology. It was the semi-annual Dominican Hospital House staff, medical staff, I should say, medical staff meeting, and learned a lot about what their experience has been from the inside. And one of the interesting things that one of the infectious disease doctors commented on is, yes, we are in fact starting to use prednisone or methylprednisolone, their first cousins, in these early cases. And that is emerging as a best practice. This next article tends to emphasize why the other best practice that Dr. Kornfield was promoting back in early May is also gaining traction. This is a new study published in the journal Radiology, and it is looking at the United States, specifically the Henry Ford Health System in Detroit, and their emergency room results for a period of about the last month. And they were looking at pulmonary embolism and also when was it diagnosed. You know, it's really nice to have older siblings. I didn't, but I was always envious because, you know, if you've got an older sibling, they can kind of tell you who you, you know, which homeroom you want to be in and, you know, how to play certain games. And Europe is effectively our older sibling. And so we get to learn from Europe, who is roughly a month ahead of us on their curve in terms of the large scale things that are playing out. And there's a great deal of variability in Europe, just as much variability as there is here in the United States between the states, which is no surprise because, you know, they're roughly the same size. Many European countries are smaller than the average state, particularly here in the West. So in Europe, most cases of pulmonary embolism had been diagnosed much later, after ICU admission, sometimes after several days. But now they're diagnosing it in up to 70% of people who don't require ICU care. And part of that has to do that because we have CT angiography. And so here's a retrospective study of 328 COVID patients. 22% of those who were admitted to the hospital had a pulmonary embolism. This is a blood clot in the lungs. If you had a body mass index of 30 or higher, in other words, you're officially medically obese, your risk was 3 times greater. So that is a substantial risk factor. And essentially, I think we should be drawing D-dimer and a blood saturation, arterial blood gas, if you please, not those finger things, for anyone obese who walks through the door with any kind of symptom. Another thing that came out of this is that patients on statin therapy prior to admission were less likely to develop a pulmonary embolism. This is rather unexpected, and the only thing that links statins to pulmonary embolism is the fact that statins are, in fact, anti-inflammatory, and that may, in fact, be the major reason that they reduce heart attack rates. C-reactive protein and D-dimer, in conjunction with a rising oxygen requirement, would be a predictor, and even people who are already receiving preventative blood thinners probably need to get put on heparin. So that interview that we heard a month ago is starting to be at the same time, simultaneously, as the data was emerging, and it's getting published to support the hypotheses that were being promoted. So I'm hoping that we will be learning more and refining our therapeutic techniques. Fortunately, California is basically Germany. If we're going to use Europe as a model, we did well and continue to do well. A few hot pockets, obviously, in the crowded urban areas, which is to be expected. But overall, the chances of a major problem in terms of a flooding of the hospital system, that danger has really passed. And my compliments to all of the first responders, all of the hospital administrators, all of the doctors, nurses, orderlies, food people, delivery people, and all of the people who stayed home, who managed to do that. We need to give ourselves a high five, folks, because we have dodged a bullet. And it's not going to be fun, but it's not going to be horrible. And I am happy to be able to tell you about that. The next part of the program is dedicated to vaccines. There are basically 3 ways to make vaccines. And vaccination goes way back. The earliest ways that vaccination was done was to actually take a pustule, that is to say a boil of smallpox, and cut it open and poke a little bit of it under the skin of someone. Now, since smallpox is normally a respiratory virus, poking it into the skin did not generally give you smallpox, but it did give you antibodies. And that was the first vaccination. Well, that's not going to work for many diseases, particularly viruses. And so now we have 3 ways to make vaccines. We have the live attenuated vaccine, and this is primarily used for viruses, where you weaken the virus. You hit it with compounds that cause its cell wall to be weaker. You interfere with its functioning. You make it easier for the immune system to spot. example of an injectable weakened virus is measles, mumps, rubella. These viruses, we've never been able to get a killed virus vaccine to work. These, by the way, are highly, highly contagious, high R0 or R0 transmission diseases. We talked about R0 a couple of weeks ago. That's how many people one person who's sick is likely to make sick. And measles is 12 to 15 people, while COVID, SARS-CoV-2 is actually a 3 to 5 R0. By the way, by sheltering in place, we've gotten that R0 below 1. So the R0 that I saw calculated was 0.62 while we were in complete shelter in place. It's going to go up now. You could make the argument that it needs to. I don't want to have that conversation. I don't think we know enough to know what's the right move at this point. I do think we know that we need to be socially distancing and wearing masks if we're going to do this, unless we're moving rapidly through space. The next type of vaccine is killed organisms or fragments of a killed organism or fragments of virus. A good example of this would be tetanus toxoid, which is the Clostridia tetani toxin. You put that in the body makes antibodies against it. They neutralize the toxin. If you do get tetanus, it doesn't kill you. It doesn't even make you sick. Most of the pneumonia vaccines use the fragment of the surface of the pneumococcus, and injectable polio uses killed poliovirus. But I mentioned that technology has marched on, and in the wake of the Genome Project and being able to custom build DNA and insert it into cells and make those cells reproduce that DNA, we've entered a new age of recombinant protein vaccination. So this method works as follows. Step one, analyze the DNA or the RNA of the virus. If it's an RNA virus like COVID-19, you then have to run it through a step called reverse transcriptase to get DNA. And then you find the genes that code for your target protein. In the case of COVID, most of the vaccines are targeting the spike protein. The spike protein is the thing that's studded on the surface of the COVID dandelion. And those are the things that attach to the ACE or the ACE2 receptor that we've all heard so much about by now. Step three, you build the protein and you teach the immune system to attack it. You can do this by inserting it into cells using a vector, but this is a very non-trivial step. Getting the protein into the right place so that the immune system can see it and start manufacturing antibodies to it is actually quite hard. It's easy to do this and have it not work because you can make an antibody to the protein, but it might be the wrong part of the protein. So we'll get to this 3D conundrum in a moment. But first, I'm going to use the example of respiratory syncytial virus to illustrate how difficult it is to make a safe, effective vaccine. We still don't have one for RSV. And there have been several generations of RSV vaccines, and some of them have backfired fairly spectacularly. What can possibly go wrong? Well, in the 1960s, they made an inactivated RSV vaccine, which backfired. The infected children, vaccinated children, actually got sicker when they were finally exposed. They were not only were they not immune, they got sicker than people who hadn't been vaccinated. So part of the reason that happened is that this spike protein we're talking about, it's like a Chinese finger trap. It's like one of those spheres that you see that can change shape. It is a dynamic structure with hinges. And so when it is on the surface of the virus before the virus has managed to attach, it has one shape. When it attaches, that shape changes, kind of like a spring being sprung, or think of a catapult or a trebuchet. You know, it's got the loaded and it's got the post-fired configuration, and it looks quite different geometrically. So you want to be sure that you're making your antibodies against the infectious but pre attached form, because that's what you want to neutralize. What if you make it to the backside, the part that doesn't change configuration? It's not going to have a neutralizing benefit. And you don't know that until you test. And that's what all this, will it work, do we have it, is all about. In dengue fever, the vaccines actually made a cytokine storm. And that has to do with the fact that there are many different strains of dengue fever. And normally, the first one you get is the flu. You only get really sick and have a cytokine storm from dengue if you get a second infection of a substantially different strain. And then your immune system just goes crazy and you get something similar to what happens in the cytokine storm of COVID, an overactive and dangerous immune response. So when they tried to invent a dengue vaccine, what they ended up doing was loading the gun for the cytokine storm. There's another situation, another particularly bad vaccine failure. Once the virus was coated with antibodies, it was neutralized. It couldn't infect its target respiratory tissue, but it wasn't dead. And the macrophages, which are the big eater cells, amoebas that eat bacteria and antibody-coated viruses, came along and engulfed it. And in the process of trying to digest the virus, it actually took all the antibody off, reactivated the virus, and the macrophages, which are traveling cells that move throughout the body and the bloodstream and are capable of getting into your body tissues as well, spread the infection. So you can have some pretty colossal fails with vaccine. I said I was going to talk about configuration, and I struggled a little bit to explain this, but I think I've come up with a good one for you. So I want you to take your hand and put your thumb against your index finger and lay it out flat on the table, okay? And let's suppose that's one form of the virus. Now, I want you to take your hand and make, and let's suppose we make antibodies to the tips of your second through fifth fingers. Now I want you to take your hand, curl your fingers into a fist, and hold your thumb up. So now this 3D structure looks completely different. And an antibody that's made for the flat hand thumb in is not going very likely to be able to recognize the closed hand thumb up. And that summarizes the issue with why it's so hard to develop vaccines. And just for context, up until the Ebola virus, the average time to develop vaccine was 10 years. And we'll go through the phases of that development in just a second. But Ebola was amazing. They got the Ebola vaccine, which unfortunately didn't work very well, but they got it in 5 years. And that was a big forward step. Now people are talking about 18 to 24 months. And while it's amazing, because they're really jumping over a lot of the initial hurdles, we really do have to step back and not expect the cavalry to arrive in 18 months, you know, June of 2021. Don't hold your breath. We can get around a lot of the problems that I've already talked about by building the protein from synthetic DNA that we've used to infect cell culture. We can also get around it by inserting the protein into the body cells. And so that strategy is one of the strategies we'll be talking about in a moment with the current new vaccines. So let's do a little timeline here. January 11th, 2020, the gene sequence for COVID-19 is published. By April, the first of the vaccines, the earliest one to the table, came out of, I think, Germany or Switzerland. And they had something that they were working on in 2 weeks, which was just amazing. That one's kind of fallen by the wayside. So far as I know, it's certainly not on the list of current ones that are in phase one trials or approaching phase one trials. So what the heck do the phases mean? Well, phase one means you give the vaccine to a small group of very healthy people and you see if it makes them sick. At the same time you're doing that, you give it to an animal model. As it happens, we do have a good animal model in macaque monkeys. They can be infected by this. So you see if it protects them. And the turnaround time for that is a couple of months. So then you move to phase two. Phase two is larger groups, and, you know, thousands of people, including children, women, older people. And again, you're primarily looking to see what kind of antibody are you getting and do you hurt anybody? Are there groups that can't take it? Pregnant women is always a big concern in phase two trials and also a huge liability, obviously. Phase three is when even larger groups are given and we start testing human effectiveness. And human effectiveness means, by the way, that you take people and expose them to virus. You essentially, they become human guinea pigs and they are inoculated with virus. And you also do studies where you just watch, you check high-risk populations. Nursing home patients comes to mind. That's a high-risk population. And see if you can protect them. As of the end of April, there were 115 vaccine candidates. We're going to talk about just a few of them. So I want to talk first about a vaccine that's being put out by a group called CanSino. This is a collaboration in China. It's a number of different companies. And remember why I said it's hard to get your protein into cells? Well, this one has an adenovirus vector. The adenovirus is one of the cold viruses, and essentially what they do is they doctor the DNA of the adenovirus so that it expresses the COVID-19 spike protein on its surface. But inside the cell, what gets injected into you is just good old ordinary cold virus. And that is a reasonably safe way to do it. And what they're seeing is that they had minor adverse effects, and they did show T cell responses and a neutralizing antibody, but they don't know if they're getting titers that are high enough to be protective. In other words, they're getting some antibody, but is it enough? And that's going to be hard to figure out. Unfortunately, there is a serious lack of standardization in the way people are assessing their vaccines. And because we don't have a standard virus neutralization assay, oh, and boy, should we have that. That's something the World Health Organization should have just put out there. Give us a model and let us work with that model and let everybody work with the same model. So at least we're comparing apples and apples. So this worked pretty well in a trial HIV vaccine. The problem was, that was about 10 years ago. The problem with this adenovirus vector is that in the United States and Africa, about 45% of people already have antibodies against this adenovirus. So in Asia, it's not that prevalent. In Africa, it's 90%. United States is 45%. So that's not going to be a good vaccine for global use. There's another vaccine that's put together by a group called Medina, and this is an RNA-based vaccine that is getting modest levels of neutralizing antibody. It is very specifically directed against the receptor binding domain of the S protein. So probably what this will be able to do is protect the lower respiratory tract, which is, of course, what kills us. This is very similar to what happens with flu vaccine. You can't get enough neutralizing antibody into your nasal mucus for the vaccine to be helpful there. So people would still get it in their nose and still be contagious. So if this turns out to be the vaccine that we use, we may all be wearing masks for a very, very long time. As we look at these vaccines, there's another company called INO4800. This one has a very unique way of getting the virus in. It loads the DNA that encodes the S protein into a plasmid, which is a little round bit of DNA. And it's sort of like like one of those little key rings that has the hook, it has the single hook on it. They fit together. And you can put 1,000 keys on one of those things. You can get very creative with those key rings. Well, that little daisy chain of DNA is getting into the cells by a process called electroporation. So they're literally going back to Jenner, where he's poking stuff into your skin. They're running it through your skin by basically disrupting the barrier functioning of your skin to get it into the subcutaneous tissue where the immune system is abundant and picks it up and presents it to the appropriate cells and starts making a T cell response and also eventually antibody. So in 5 years, we've gone to 5 years for Ebola, which was twice normal speed, to maybe 5 months to get our current trials. We're moving very fast here, and we don't know how good the first vaccines will be. We're used to them working, and we're used to, oh, there's a vaccine and it's going to work. And the reason we're used to that is because it normally takes 10 years. And as we try to collapse that process, we introduce a whole lot of unknowns because there simply isn't time to do the kind of validation studies that are normally done because those take 5 years. And we all feel that we don't have 5 years. I think as a planet, we feel we don't have 5 years on this. And then we come to the biggest problem. And this is one anyone who's ever had a successful internet business or ended up with a denial of service attack will understand. It's scaling. If we get a vaccine which is good and successful, how on earth are we going to make enough of it? It takes a long time to build vaccine factories. And depending upon which of these very different vaccines turns out to be the winner, those factories are going to look very different. So we have to figure that out because even once we have it, who gets it? Social justice, distribution, and is there any way that we can sort of start cracking the manufacturing nut now, working in parallel, at least, you know, locating facilities, maybe candidate facilities, depending upon which technology is going to be used. Maybe we build one of each or 20 of each and hope we guess right on what technology we're going to need. It's a huge problem. And I'm happy to say that there's a whole lot of people working on it. There's a big golden ticket for the person who, or the persons, the companies, the countries that get the right vaccine. But that just becomes the beginning of this story, really, when you think about the practical aspects of distributing it in the population. I have a comment from a listener. I think you should balance these vaccine failures to not support complete anti-vaxxers. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Okay, thank you very much. I think that's an important comment. Thank you to whoever made it. The baby with the bathwater thing. Yes, if a vaccine comes out that is flawed or doesn't, it'll be a see, we told you it's all a fraud. That is obviously, it's the sort of thing that is factually in error and is a sign of, you know, complete ignorance about exactly how complicated and difficult this is. And the reason I decided to devote 20 minutes of this program was exactly that, to address, this is hard. This, you don't land a triple axel the first time you get out there on the ice with skates. And I really think it's important that we acknowledge that. And as far as people who want to believe that vaccines are not helpful, I'll see that and raise you a bad case of measles pneumonia when you pull this and your kid infects you, because adults get very, very sick. So I am now going to go to emails. Just a reminder, if you don't email during the show, you can also send an email to askdrdawn.com. And there, if you click on the audio archives, you'll find shows and lists of topics dating back, well, quite a while at this point. So what I'd like to do is go to our first email. This is Shaul in Israel, and Shaul's a regular. Subject, Dr. Dawn, how to clean fruits and vegetables. Thank you for your previous answer. What is your opinion on these two articles? And one of the articles was a stub. It was actually a Huffington Post article about the George Floyd case. So wrong link. Sorry, Shaul. The link that was a scientific story. It came from ACS Publications, and it was looking at the effectiveness of commercial and homemade washing agents in removing pesticides residues on and in apples. And it was from an agricultural journal. And it's amazing what you trip over on the internet. I love wandering around the science stuff, but, you know, that's me. Essentially, it was quite an interesting article, and I thank Shaw for bringing it to my attention. They did some rather sophisticated laser surface mapping to identify pesticides that were commonly used on apples, and then they subjected the apples to three different treatments, washing them off in tap water, which is what the FDA recommends for cleaning fruits and vegetables. Now, it doesn't work for pesticides very well. They're sticky. Using Clorox bleach, I'm presuming that they didn't use straight bleach, but rather a dilute solution, but maybe they used straight bleach. The abstract doesn't really say. And baking soda. And I was very surprised to see that of these three methods, baking soda was actually much more effective than the Clorox or the tap water in removing pesticide residue. Now, we're not talking about viral particles here. And I think what may have prompted Charles sending me this article was the program that, or a little program segment I did about cleaning your fruits and vegetables in a two-step process. And I used the second step, soap, for the pesticide residues. But I'm going to switch to bicarb. Not too big a deal. 10 milligrams per milliliter. So if you're going to dip vegetables, you're probably going to want 10,000 milligrams, which is basically a little under a tablespoon of bicarbonate of soda, baking soda, in other words. So a tablespoon of baking soda in a quart of water is going to take off most of the pesticides. Not all, because some of the pesticides penetrate into the peel. And so my attitude is, if it's an organic apple, I'm not so worried. Maybe there'll be a little bit of brushed on. If it's not organic, I'm probably going to do the bicarb soak. Let's see, how long did they soak it for? 12 to 15 minutes to completely remove the pesticide residues. So drop it in a basin, come back later. For things like apples, that's going to work quite well. If you're really worried or you're environmentally sensitive, you probably want to peel the apple. Unfortunately, if you do that, you're going to lose a lot of the quercetin, which tends to hang out in the skin of the apple, but you will still be getting all of that lovely pectin, which is a favorite food of good bacteria. So maybe an apple a day really does keep the doctor away. Our next email comes from J.A.R. in Aptos. The subject is pancreatic cancer. Dear Dr. Don, do you have a podcast on pancreatic cancer? Is there something in your archive and what date? My friend just had a preliminary diagnosis of stage 4 on May 29th, 2020. So, J.A., I sent you an article that I found after receiving your email. And I'm going to share some of the information in it with the audience because we've made some fairly substantial advances in pancreatic cancer. It still remains a serious disease. It's one of the highest mortality of all the cancers. And there were about 45,000 deaths from pancreatic cancer in 2019 in the U.S. So it's not rare, and it's probably going, as we make enormous progress in breast, prostate, and colorectal cancers, it's probably going to be the leading cause of cancer-related death. That being said, there have been some very interesting synergistic techniques that have been developed over the last few years. And we're really talking about between 2017 and now. So I really do mean the last few years. And it has really revolutionized the approach to pancreatic cancer. A lot of times what is being done now is combination chemotherapy using, paclitaxel, which is related to the yew tree, Taxol, that compound that proved to be so important in certain types of breast cancer where the HER2 new was present, cisplatin, which is a platinum-based chemotherapy agent, and gemcitabine. And these are standard chemotherapies, and they're used in combination and given prior to surgery. A lot of times pancreatic cancer has spread, but it's still resectable. And when you take away the bulk of the tumor, the chemo works much better, and you were able to get decent survival times. So you could take a cancer which is technically not surgically resectable, give this heavy-duty chemotherapy, and then the cancer shrinks enough that you can actually get it out there. This can also be done with radiation, and as usual, there's an argument going on about whether or not radiation and chemo, or just radiation or just chemo. But if you take a look at the survival times, the median survival times really improved quite substantially. So if you give the chemotherapy and then do the surgery in stage four, well, probably late stage three cancers, I don't have this study, it's just a review article. But basically what they were able to do was take the survival time an extra year. So you've got 26 months with just surgery and 36 months with the chemo and then surgery. So that's an increased year of life. That's worth something, particularly when you have a diagnosis of this type of cancer. Now, we have a lot of immunotherapy, and we've been using that extremely successfully on melanoma, which used to be a very, very bad cancer. Immunotherapy teaches your own immune system to attack the cancers. This has been a pretty spectacular fail thus far in pancreatic cancer. Probably has a little bit to do with just the structure of the pancreas and how difficult it is to get T cells to migrate in there to fight the cancer. But there's one exception, and that's people whose cancers show something called microsatellite instability. Immunotherapies, in this case a drug called pembrolizumab, is being approved by the FDA, or actually it has been approved for 2 years now, and it works in that particular type of cancer. So if you get a piece of the cancer and you see this microsatellite instability, or you see another DNA repair mechanism, which is impaired, and I don't think anybody understands why, but in that case, the immunotherapy seems to be working better. There's also new work going on looking at the cancers themselves and seeing what mutations they have, and do they have any mutations we can target. And there are a number of genes that are frequently mutated in pancreatic cancer. So individualized therapy for this cancer may prove to be the ultimate thing that helps us improve the case. And things are moving very, very quickly here. So I hope that you will show this article to your friend. I hope it will give him a little bit of hope, because obviously this is in everybody's head as, I'm going to die tomorrow, or I'm going to die in 6 months. And, you know, maybe not. Maybe if we're getting the median survival up that much compared to surgery alone, I'm guardedly optimistic.
Hello.
Hello there. Who am I talking with?
How are you?
Hi.
You're talking to Jim from Los Gatos.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, good evening. I have a question. I'm 65 years old, but for about 3 or 4 years, I've had trouble with my digestive tract, diarrhea pretty much continuously, and I haven't taken any medication or anything like that. Recently, I had like a tooth issue, and I took antibiotics for 10 days, and so I took the opportunity to get some probiotics and, double up or triple up on that throughout the antibiotic treatment plus continuously afterwards, and that cleared up my problem. And I was just wondering if maybe you could kind of shed a little light on the entire issue there that might be involved.
Sure. My first question for you is, had you had antibiotics before this started? You said you'd had it for several years. I'm just wondering if maybe you'd had a previous tooth infection or a you know, whatever, a strep throat, and been treated with antibiotics.
Yeah, I've had antibiotics before, and it really messed up my stomach and pretty badly. So I had stomach issues after that for quite a while, and one time I even stopped the treatment. Then I had a different antibiotic this last time.
Yeah,
but
and
it didn't cause any problems.
Well, the thing about this is that you're right. You are in the bad. You're in the first generation who really had a crappy microbiome from birth, and that has to do, among other things, most women gave their babies formula or partially formula. Very few women you would have been born in around 1956. Very few women gave, breastfed for 2 years back then. It was not the modern way, right? It was, so we used this wonderful formula, which did not nourish the microbiome properly because the infant microbiome does not like or thrive on cow's milk. The proteins are not digestible easily, and most formulas are cow's milk based, and you get a lot of kids who are quote unquote cow's milk allergic. And you know, the soy formulas, again, they are not the same as mother's milk, and there's lots of variations. But so we're in the antibiotic generation. I'm a couple years behind you. I turned 62 at the end of the week, but we got antibiotics for ear infections. We got antibiotics for sore throats. We got lots of antibiotics growing up. And so even though we were out there playing in the dirt and, you know, inhaling pet hair and, you know, licking the dog, we didn't get those bacteria, those good soil bacteria, didn't really get a chance to be established. So, and then a lot of us had appendixes out. So we don't have a resilient microbiome, and that makes us very vulnerable, very, very tippy. I like to think of it that we can flip over into a quote-unquote dysbiosis and stay there for... It's hard to get out. If you think about a sailboat, if you lay that sailboat down in the ocean, it's going to take more than a wind to get you back up. And so I think what you did with your second round of antibiotics there was that you killed off the bad actors, and you essentially, it, like there was a vacant lot with a bunch of weeds and thistle and crabgrass, and you hit it with Roundup, which is not great, but then you went and threw wildflower seeds on it. And because the weeds were killed and killed real dead, you were able to grow back some good flowers. And so our microbiome, I would say you probably should stay on a reasonable dose of probiotics, maybe somewhere around 20, 25 billion with a B, just ongoing, the way you would take a vitamin. And that's going to improve the resilience of your gut. And you want to make sure that your diet is relatively low in crap and, you know, fast food and particularly sugars, because the bacteria that thrive from sugars are bad actors, and they are inflammatory, and they impair your immune system, and they increase your risk of allergies and all the wrong things. They increase, you know, they mess with you. And what you want is you want the bacteria that like to eat the insoluble fibers. So I mentioned pectin earlier on the show. Pectin's an insoluble fiber. It's goo. It's basically goo. And these bacteria love goo. Inulin, you'll find that in Jerusalem artichoke. You'll find that in regular artichokes. A lot of the foods that are listed as having fermentable oligosaccharides, you may have heard of the FODMAPs diet. Sometimes people with irritable bowel take it, and it works for them, because what they have, that particular flavor of irritable bowel, they have too much bacteria in their small intestine, and it's a different disease. But when they eat those foods, they feed those bacteria. Those bacteria produce a lot of gas, and the person's very uncomfortable. So if you have that situation, you have to do some more additional reboots. But effectively, you accidentally rebooted your gut. God bless it. And now your job is to just keep it in this state rather than in the previous state that you were suffering from. So lots of fiber and lots of fruits and veggies, an apple a day, a root vegetable a day. Root vegetables are awesome because they carry probiotics that, just like that pesticide penetrates under the skin, you cannot sterilize a potato. The bacterial spores in the soil are very resistant to heat. And so you can bake that potato, you'll still get some good probiotic spores in there, and you'll get benefit from them. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I like potatoes. That's one of my favorite foods. And I usually bake them, you know, like 400 degrees or whatever for a while.
The fiber is unaffected, and you still get some spores. And I would take the probiotics, though. And that would be my recommendation if you came and saw me as a patient. If there's any, and when I send people out to on trips, a lot of doctors will give them Cipro and Imodium. That's the CDC's treatment for traveler's diarrhea. That's the recommendation. I hate Cipro. Cipro is an antibiotic that damages the tendons, and it can cause chronic pain problems because people's tendons get loose and they develop back pain. It lasts forever. You're in there doing prolotherapy to try to fix them. So anyway, I give people probiotics, and I tell them to take about 150 billion worth of probiotics every 4 to 6 hours if they start to get diarrhea. And I give them some Pepto-Bismol tablets, and I say, if you're eating anything dodgy, if it's street food, if it's, you're not, you know, it's like, I'm really hungry, I'm going to eat this, but I'm not sure I should, then you chew up 4 Pepto-Bismol tablets because your stomach will be full of bismuth, which is very toxic to E. coli, and it is not an antibiotic. It is a temporary, it's the equivalent of hand sanitizer for that meal. So you're getting rid of the bacteria that's coming in on that food, but you're not able to really do much else, and you're not going to hurt your microbiome substantially taking Pepto-Bismol that way. And I have found over the years it's a much kinder, gentler, safer way to deal with traveler's diarrhea. And avoiding, because that's really what you want. You want to avoid it, but if you get it, some people demand the Cipro, and I'll cave and give them the Cipro with a warning. But that particular class of drugs deserves to be used on serious life-threatening infections because it has some substantial, not rare, unusual, but not rare side effects that are to be avoided.
When I'm traveling, taking some long flights or something like that, sometimes my stomach will get very upset. And what I've done is I've just taken some raw, old-fashioned oatmeal and the thick stuff, and then I just ask the stewardess for, some hot water in a cup. So that settles everything. And I've always kind of used that for diarrhea as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's necessarily been all that helpful, but it has kept my stomach in better shape. But that was prior to this resolution that recently occurred with this antibiotic and probiotic.
You know what I would try the next time? I mean, is an experiment. I think you might find that chia seed would work very well because it creates this kind of mucus. So chia seed you can buy, it's dried seed, little tiny. Remember the chia pets from like the 70s?
I buy that actually for some of my hot cereal that I mix.
Excellent. You just take like a teaspoon of, it's a tablespoon of chia seeds. I think that's the ratio. I might be off on the ratio. Start with a teaspoon in a third of a cup of water. And if it doesn't turn into pudding, then use a tablespoon. I got the amount wrong. But you get this kind of soft pudding effect. It's very, very helpful because it acts like mucus in the stomach. So it might coat the stomach, which I think what you're doing with your oatmeal. And I think you may have a problem making an adequate stomach mucus. And people who have that issue often do very well with something called DGL. Which is a form, it's diglycerated licorice, and it has, if you eat too much licorice, it messes with your blood pressure and your potassium levels. But if you take the diglycerated licorice, you can take large quantities, it doesn't mess with you, and it's very good for pinch hitting for your stomach mucus if you have a mucus production issue. And by the way, having bad bacteria or will affect the production of your stomach mucus. There's all these feedback loops involved in the microbiome. It's this huge Pandora's box. Since we opened it, it's like everything is connected to everything else. It's just crazy making sometimes.
Some other cereal that I make is with buckwheat and I'll throw in some other grains, gluten-free type of stuff. Is there anything I might benefit from knowing from that?
I'd probably add some oat bran. I'd probably add some, if you're using oatmeal that's like steel cut, you're fine, you're getting the bran. But if you're using the stuff that's rolled oats, you want to throw in some oat bran. You can buy powdered inulin, which would be another source of fiber. The more fiber you eat, the healthier your microbiome is going to be. And so that's, you know, things that you can throw in that cereal. Inulin you can buy as a powder and just add a teaspoon in there, and that will really feed some of the very important probiotics, I-N-U-L-I-N.
I'll look that up. Thank you very much, Dr. Duncan.
You're welcome. Thank you for the call, and keep listening.
I sure will. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. I should mention that if you are going to be taking antibiotics and probiotics at the same time, I recommend to people that you try to keep a two-hour distance between the antibiotics and the probiotics. You just sort of think of it like an assembly, like your digestion is an assembly line, and you don't want the probiotics and the antibiotics in the same room. So if you just keep them separated by a couple of hours, for most people, their transit time is such that that will be fine. Let's go to that story, actually. I had mentioned the gut-brain thing, and our caller certainly got us on that topic. And that is the new gut-brain link, how gut mucus could help treat brain disorders. Mucus is the first line of defense against bad bacteria in our gut. I think I said that already. And we know that there is a link between bacterial imbalance and Alzheimer's disease, autism, and other brain disorders. In fact, the autism and gut bacteria link was one of the things that Wakefield, back in the guy who got this whole anti-vax thing started, was using as support for his hypothesis. But really, we've known for decades that the microbiome of children with autism is very disrupted. And if you modify their diet and modify their microbiome, you get serious improvements in behavior. Go look it up. There's papers and, you know, plenty of data out there. Some of the bacteria eat mucus. Some of them actually cause you to make more mucus. This is a really interesting probiotic called Acromania mansoni, and it is an anti-inflammatory probiotic, but it also stimulates the production of mucus. And if you get too much mucus, that is also very, very disruptive. So we're having a real interesting circumstance where the microbiome and the mucus are interacting with each other and somehow managing to interact with the brain. How could that be? Well, in the small intestine, the mucus is very thin and porous so that food can be absorbed through it. And it's full of peptides, which are antibacterial. So the mucus contains, effectively, micro-antibiotics that are directed against the kind of bacteria that would be coming in on your food. So if it gets through the first acid bath in your stomach, it's going to get broken down. And as I said, it acts as a food source. If you get an overgrowth of one of the bacteria that eats your mucus, you're going to end up with a leaky gut. And there's a new review that just came out that suggests that that there's an association with reduced gut mucus production and all neurologic diseases, but particularly we're looking at Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis. And by the way, people with those diseases have unique fingerprints of bacteria. It may be, you know, I think it's Margaret Atwood who wrote the Oryx and Crake series, which is a wonderful science fiction story. But part of that is that your toilet is your doctor, because it just diagnoses what's wrong with you based on your urine and your poop and tells you what you need to do. And who knows, that may prove to be back in the day, you know, doctors would examine poop. You know what, folks, I'm going to have to pick this up next week. I realize I've gone over time. Great apologies to Howard. And this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.